From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Native American writer Jim Northrup. After fighting in Vietnam, he returned to the reservation where he was born, in northern Minnesota, to live a traditional Chippewa life. Of course, traditions are changing. There's a gambling casino on the reservation now. Also, Cuban emigre jazz musician Paquito de Rivera. Back in Cuba, his friends used to call him Paquito the American because he liked American music so much, only he wasn't allowed to play it. And book critic John Leonard reviews James Lee Burke's new mystery novel, In the Electric Mist, with Confederate dead. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Clinton has chosen a 57-year-old Army general to replace General Colin Powell as the nation's top military officer. General John Shalikashvili is currently the commander of NATO forces in Europe, with responsibility for monitoring the war in the former Yugoslavia. Shalikashvili was a Polish refugee who was drafted into the U.S. Army in 1958. He served in Korea, Vietnam, and Europe and commanded the operation to protect Kurds in northern Iraq after the Persian Gulf War. Shalikashvili told reporters today that he supports President Clinton's policy on allowing homosexuals to serve in the military. The U.S. State Department has warned Serbian forces that if they fail to withdraw from two strategic mountaintops near Sarajevo, NATO airstrikes might be launched. NPR's Ted Clark reports.
Today, State Department spokesman Mike McCurry said possession of the two mountaintops is a critical element of the Serbs' ability to strangle Sarajevo. And he noted that the strangulation of Sarajevo is one of the criteria that would trigger a response by NATO. Not the only criterion, but a very materially relevant one, he said. Reporters asked McCurry if his remark constituted a warning to the Serbs.
I don't need to warn them from here because they've been warned very directly through a diplomatic context. They are well aware of that, but if that reinforces the public warning they've received in the past, so be it.
At times, the Serbs seem determined to keep the mountains. At times, they offer to withdraw, suggesting that Serb leaders don't fully believe the NATO threats, but cannot dismiss them either. This is Ted Clark in Washington.
In a Rose Garden ceremony at the White House today, with uniformed police officers standing behind him, President Clinton unveiled his anti-crime package and reiterated support for the Brady gun control bill. NPR's Phyllis Crockett reports.
The package will include $3.4 billion over the next 5 years. It would put some 50,000 new police officers on the street, improve drug treatment programs in prison, create boot camps for young nonviolent offenders, increase penalties for certain crimes, and provide money to schools for programs to prevent crime. Recognizing the bill has no chance of passage without help from some Republicans, the president made a pitch for bipartisan support.
It's time we put aside the divisions of party and philosophy and put our best efforts to work on a crime plan.
Congressional observers say chances of a crime package passing that includes the Brady bill are good, with President Clinton's strong support. I'm Phyllis Crockett at the White House.
Stock prices rose today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 10.6 points to close at a record 3,583.35. This is NPR News. President Clinton outlined his anti-crime initiative today, including tighter controls on handgun purchases and funding to put more police officers on the street. He said the measure would provide $3.4 billion over 5 years to help pay for an additional 50,000 police officers. The U.S. Department of Agriculture announced today that starting in October, all raw meat and poultry will have to bear labels informing consumers how to cook and store these products. NPR's Joe Palka explains why USDA says the labels are necessary.
In January, an outbreak of food poisoning from hamburgers served at Jack in the Box restaurants in the state of Washington underscored the problems with meat inspection in this country. The hamburgers were contaminated with bacteria, but right now, meat is not routinely screened for bacterial contamination. Agriculture Secretary Mike Espy has promised to change that, but in the meantime, his agency is launching a campaign to explain how people can avoid any problems with bacteria. The campaign includes labels that instruct people to refrigerate or freeze all raw meat and poultry, to wash hands and countertops after contact with raw meat, to cook meat thoroughly, and to refrigerate leftovers promptly, preferably within 2 hours. These steps, says Espy, should greatly reduce, if not eliminate, the risk of illness. In Washington, I'm Joe Palca.
Weather forecasters said that scattered clouds could obscure what some say may be the best meteor show in years. The annual Perseid meteor shower will be at its height tonight and tomorrow as the Earth passes through a trail of debris left by the comet Swift-Tuttle. The shower normally shows up as about 60 streaks or shooting stars every hour. Astronomers say this year's shower could be much more intense, partly because the comet passed closer to the Earth last year than it has in more than 2,000 years. If the skies are clear, viewers could see hundreds or even thousands of shooting stars. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. After fighting in the Vietnam War, my guest Jim Northrup returned to the reservation where he was born, the Fond du Lac Reservation in northern Minnesota. Northrup is Anishinaabe, also known as Ojibwe or Chippewa. He's trying to live within his culture's traditions. When he returned to the reservation, he lived in a teepee for 6 years, but that wasn't just about tradition, it was also the result of a housing shortage on the reservation. Northrup was taken away from the reservation when he was 6 years old and sent to a government boarding school. Now he writes about his life and about the issues and controversies on his reservation. He's a columnist for several native papers and for the Minneapolis Star Tribune and the Duluth News Tribune. He has a new collection of poems and short stories called Walking the Res Road. Res is short for reservation. This is his poem, Brown and White Peak.
What's it like living on the res, I'm always asked. It's living near a lot of relatives, ready to help or gossip about your need for help. The word reservation is a misnomer. Reserve for who? The white man owns 80% of my res, Fond du Lac. Living there means finding something good in something grim. Glad for our chronic unemployment when the white guys get lung cancer from breathing asbestos at the mill. 70% unemployment on the res. Go down the road a few miles, it's 5%. We have TV, that window to America. We see you. You don't see us. I watch the news every night. Whenever they show Indians, it's always that same tired tub of walleye, maybe some kind of bingo doings. Commodities are good for you, our nutritionist says. Right. They let your stomach know your swallower still works. Eat them for the bulk, not the taste. Rice Krispies now come in commods, in addition to the Spanish lesson printed on every box and can. Cereal de arroz tostado, anyone? We live strong because we know we're just one of the generations of people called Anishinaabe. Our spirituality protects us from the excesses of the manifest destiny, dominant society. What's it like living on the res? Come walk a mile in my moccasins. Maybe we can pick up some commods.
Thanks for reading that. Why did you decide to move back to the reservation?
I always knew that I would be returning to the reservation. It seems like most Indian people I know have a large rubber band attached to them. And they go away all over the world for different lengths of time, but they always return. And so, for my part, I just got tired of living near a lot of strangers.
Would you describe the reservation that you live on?
It's woods. Back around the turn of the century, it was big pine. I think most of our wood went down to Chicago to rebuild after the fire. Lakes, wild rice lakes, mostly woods and swamps. They tell us we have a lot of peat resources, but no one's exploiting that particular resource at this time.
Are there many people on the reservation who kind of remember traditional ways, or do you feel that that's something that's been lost?
I think we are in very good shape as far as remembering the traditional ways, the traditional stories. Right now, we're forming a new tradition with the casinos.
Is that something you support or oppose?
I'm still of two minds about it. The part I don't like about it is one of the things that's helped us survive on this continent for thousands of years is our willingness to share, our generosity. And gambling to me seems to be diametrically opposed to that. That's one of the bad parts. One of the good parts is the jobs. Most of my family is working at the casino now.
So you've got this new reservation. I mean, you've got this new casino on the reservation. At the same time, you are trying to live a more traditional lifestyle. What does that mean, the traditional lifestyle?
I live my life with the seasons. The seasons dictate my activities. In the spring, I make maple syrup, and I spear fish. I was recently arrested for it because it's against the state law. But according to the 1854 and the 1837 treaty, we reserved the right to hunt, fish, and gather. So we'll be going to court in another couple weeks about that. In the summertime, I make birch bark fanning baskets called New Scotchanoggin, used for winnowing wild rice, separating the hulls from the grain. And then, of course, in a couple weeks, we'll be starting to harvest wild rice and turn it into food. And then the hunting season is here, and we'll hunt moose and deer, rabbits and ducks, put away food for the winter. And then the winter time, of course, is a storytelling time, and that's when I do the bulk of my writing.
Right. The state law that you were being charged with breaking when you were spearfishing, was that because you were catching fish that aren't legally supposed to be caught, or is it because of the method of fishing with a spear?
The method of fishing, using a light and possessing a spear before the normal Minnesota spearfishing season, which is usually the winter.
Oh, I see. So you were doing it out of season. That's what it was? That's what
well,
the
out of
was?
Season and using a light.
Using a light.
Yeah, I've got a motorcycle headlight rigged up to a motorcycle helmet that runs to a car battery. It's probably 100,000 candle power. And with that light, I can see the fish.
You know, that doesn't sound real traditional to me. I guess what you're doing is a real mix of contemporary technology and tradition.
Yes, I'm not trying to live 100 years ago. I believe a culture has to change to survive, and this is one of the many changes.
I want to ask you a little bit about the tradition that you're from. You're Chippewa?
Yes, we're also called Ojibwe. And our name for ourselves is Anishinaabe.
And what does that mean?
The literal definition of Anishinaabe is from whence descended the male of the species, or the original man.
And are there particular, this is a real outsider kind of question, so forgive me, but are there particular parts of Chippewa culture that you feel relate to your life, you know, the way you're trying to live it?
Yes, I believe it's the strength that comes from the old stories, the instructions on how to live a good life. Those pieces relate to the way I live mine.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Jim Northrup, and he lives on the Fond du Lac Reservation near Duluth, Minnesota. And he has a new book of poems and short stories called Walking the Res Road. He also writes a syndicated newspaper column. I'm interested in your background. I know that you were forced to go to a federal boarding school when you were 6 years old. You actually have a poem about that called Ditched. Can I ask you to read it?
Sure. Ditched. A first grader, a federal boarding school, Pipestone, said Aneen to the first grown-up. Got an icy blue-eyed stare in return. Got a beating from a second grader for crying about the stare. Couldn't tell Ma or Dad. Both were 300 miles away. Couldn't write, didn't know how. Couldn't mail, didn't know how. Run away, got caught. Got an icy blue stare and a beating. Got another beating from a second grader for crying about the blue-eyed beating. Institutionalized, toughed it out, survived.
How did you manage to get sent away at the age of six? What happened?
I think it was common practice at the time to try to educate us in the white man's way and try to separate us from our culture, and it seemed to be quite effective because there are some things that about our history, about our language, that I don't know that I would have ordinarily learned had I been at home.
Did your parents approve of your going? Did they want you to stay home?
They wanted me to stay home, but there was some economic coercion and some government coercion to send myself and my sister to this boarding school.
What seemed the most foreign to you about life at this school?
Not hearing my language, not hearing the stories, not hearing a drum.
So did you grow up speaking your native language?
Yes.
Which is,
and I grew up hearing the drum every weekend.
What was the occasion for the drum?
Just a dance, a social dance and ceremonies.
After several years at this school, you were sent to a Christian high school. Whose decision was that?
Once again, I think it was economic coercion.
What do you mean by that?
People would talk to my parents and say, well, you have 12 children here. If we take two of them off your hands, it'll be easier for the rest of them. So my older sister and I were selected as the sacrificial lambs.
So when you got out of school, you had spent like your entire childhood in institutions far away from home. What did you do next? Suddenly you had the choice of going where you wanted to go. Where did you go?
I joined another institution, the United States Marine Corps.
Was the thought of freedom too much to handle?
No, it wasn't that so much. It was the idea that we are warriors, and it was my turn.
Because of the Vietnam War?
No, this is before the Vietnam War. This was in the early 60s, 1961 I joined,
mm-hmm.
right after high school.
You did end up in Vietnam?
Yes.
For what, a year?
13 months and 9 days.
Yeah, you were counting. What about your time in Vietnam? Did that fit in with the warrior tradition that you had in your mind?
Yes, it did. I was an infantryman, and I spent a lot of time walking through the rice paddies and the jungles with a rifle, looking for people who were looking for me.
You have some very bitter poems about the war.
It was probably the most traumatic event in my life. The boarding schools and the life on the reservation was small compared to the things that were happening in Vietnam.
Let me ask you to read a poem that's actually about your brother.
Yes. It's called Wabigan. Did you ever hear a sound, smell something, taste something that brought you back to Vietnam instantly? Did you ever wonder when it would end? It ended for my brother. He died in the war, but didn't fall down for 15 tortured years. His flashbacks are over. Another casualty whose name will never be on the wall. Some can only find peace in death. The sound of his family crying hurt. The smell of the flowers didn't comfort us. The bitter taste in my mouth still sours me. How about a memorial for those who made it through the war, but still died before their time?
How did your brother die?
Alcohol was involved and a motor vehicle was involved. And we're not sure of all of the details, just that he ended up dead.
And you connect this with his experiences in Vietnam?
Yes. He had never really settled back into society after the war.
Did you have trouble settling into?
Yes, I did.
What kind of trouble?
I knew there was something wrong with me when I came back. I was what it was later called post-traumatic stress disorder. I was going through that before it had a name. And I just knew there was something wrong with me. I was tense. I was always alert. Wasn't sleeping very good. And basically, I wanted to stay drunk all the time.
How did you stop drinking?
I realized what it was doing to me. I talked with one of my older uncles who had been in Guadalcanal in the South Pacific in World War II. And he told me that the memories will never go away, but drinking intensifies them. So I decided I didn't want any more intense memories of the war.
Did you find that there were a lot of Native Americans like you and like your brother who were in the war, came back, and had a really hard time adjusting?
I think actually we had an easier time because of the respect that veterans have in the Indian community. Before I left, I went through a ceremony with my grandfather, and when I came back, I had ceremonies. So actually, I think because of the way people feel about veterans, we did have an easier time than most non-Indian veterans.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Jim Northrup. He lives on the Fond du Lac Reservation near Duluth, Minnesota. He's the author of the new book, Walking the Res Road, which collects his poems and short stories. We're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air. Native American writer Jim Northrup is my guest. Now, you became a sheriff for a while. I'm not sure where or
on the reservation.
Oh, on the reservation.
Yeah.
How long was that after the war?
About a year and a half.
What was it? Yeah, go ahead.
At the time, I was an adrenaline junkie. After being in combat, life is pretty tame. So as a deputy sheriff, I had the trappings of the uniform. I had the, I carried a weapon, and I was making split-second life and death decisions.
How long did you stay in that job?
2 years as a deputy sheriff, and then I went down to Waukegan, Illinois, where I became a city police officer.
Really? How did you like that?
Once again, it satisfied my need for adrenaline, but I was worried about the person I was changing into. My wife would tell me it was raining, and I would always have to look outside to make sure. I didn't believe anyone, and the world was divided between us and them, those with a badge and those without.
Is that why you gave it up?
Yes.
Well, how did you get from this high adrenaline kind of life, the need to like always be in danger, I guess, to the life that you're living now, where you're a writer, you're trying to live a more traditional lifestyle? It seems like a pretty big change to me.
Actually, the change took quite a few years. Over the years, I've noticed that as I get older, I don't need that adrenaline as much as I used to when I was 25 or 30.
Your grandfather, I believe, was a writer.
Yes.
What kind of writing did he do?
Basically, he was an ombudsman for the people who couldn't speak English, but he would take time out from that to write stories. He wrote a long novella called Wawina. It is a story about the coming of the Black Robes, the Catholic priests, and it was set in the 1600s. And when he was writing, he would also explain things about our culture and our beliefs and just a day-to-day life.
Can I ask how your grandfather got an Anglo name, an Anglicized name?
I'm not sure. It happened in 1886. Before our name was Northrup, it was Winnebujou, who, if you're familiar with Chippewa stories, is a man who is half god and half man. So that was our tribal name on my father's side before we became Northrup.
Mm-hmm. No, so, yeah, go ahead.
I'm really not sure how it happened.
Mm-hmm. You created a character who is it's a recurring character through a lot of your stories. His name is Luke Warmwater. Tell me about the character, about naming him.
I actually stole the name from my uncle, who used to use it back in the 50s when he was, he would travel to Minneapolis or St. Paul and meet someone and he would register in a hotel as Luke Warmwater. And I chose it because it illustrates how Chippewas use humor as a survival tool.
did people pick up on that?
They eventually do. At first glance, they don't, but then eventually they say, hey, I know what you're saying.
So tell me about the character that you've given that name to.
I guess he's a character who's experienced some of the things that I've experienced in my life. Kind of a happy-go-lucky, devil-may-care sort of person who always seems to look for the humor in any situation. Once again, to illustrate that humor is a survival tool. We're not the cigar store kind of Indians. Or, as one of the writers put it, we don't let cigar stores sneak up behind us.
You know, I have to say, you've compared this character to you. You haven't given a lot of indications during this interview that you're the happy-go-lucky type.
Oh, but I am. My column called Fond du Lac Follies has a section called Question of the Month, where I just try to answer the sometimes silly questions white people ask us, and some of the answers are sarcastic, some of them are silly, but I just have a lot of fun with it.
What are some of those questions so I can try to make sure not to ask them?
Question, do you speak your language? Answer, yep, yours too. Or, question, are you full-blooded Indian? Answer, pint low, just got back from the blood bank.
Yeah.
Or, question, why do you call it a res instead of a reservation? Answer, because the white man owns most of it.
Oh, what are the big controversies you've been writing about in your column lately?
I've been writing about spearfishing, of course, since I'm
right.
In Mille Lacs County, my name is defendant. I've been writing about spearfishing, and I've been writing about the new casino that opened up.
Mm-hmm.
They originally told us it would cost $3 million. And now it's up to $7 million, and they're projecting $27 million. And it's kind of frightening to me, who is living close to the poverty line, to hear people talking about a million here and a million there. So I've been writing about that. I've been writing about the Jay Treaty of 1794 that allows Indians access back and forth across the Canadian-U.S. border. In fact, I just took part in a rally to demonstrate our concern about that. Treaty rights is one of my recurring issues. Gambling, that always seems to come up.
Mm-hmm.
And when the tribal government takes a two-week workshop in Reno and the workshop is canceled, but they still go, I write about things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of like the Jack Anderson of the reservation.
So one last question. What kind of work are you doing for the rest of the month in terms of the more, you know, traditional work that you've been doing?
Well, now we're in the preparing for wild rice, so I'm making sure that my canoe is seaworthy. I'm making sure that I have my rice knockers and my pole is strong enough to propel me through the rice. Yesterday I was in a PBS movie.
You really are living in two different cultures at the same time.
Yes, I sometimes come to the city and I forget to lock my car or take the keys out. And at home, I carefully lock it up in the driveway. So sometimes I have my city eyes on and at the wrong time.
I want to thank you awfully much for talking with us. Thank you.
Thank you.
Jim Northrup's new book, Walking the Res Road, is published by Voyager Press. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, Jazz in Disguise. We talk with Cuban-born saxophonist and composer Paquito de Rivera. When he played jazz in Cuba, he often called it something else because the government considered jazz the music of an imperialist country. De Rivera defected to the United States in 1980. And book critic John Leonard reviews the new Dave Robichaux mystery by James Lee Burke. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. President Clinton has proposed anti-crime legislation that would put 50,000 more police on the streets and control the importation and sale of guns. The proposal also limits the appeals process in capital punishment cases, a controversial provision that sunk last year's crime bill. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
Flanked by police officers, President Clinton moved back to the political center today, emphasizing the need to get tough on crime. In a Rose Garden appearance, the president said the first duty of government is to keep its citizens safe, and too many Americans are not safe today. The president outlined the details of this year's congressional anti-crime effort. Many elements are straight out of last year's bill, which was mired in disputes over gun control, death row appeals, search and seizure requirements, and rules of evidence. The chairman of the House and Senate Judiciary Committees say they've solved at least one of those disputes. The bill would limit state inmates to a single federal habeas corpus appeal, subject to a 6-month time period, but also ensure that poor defendants in capital cases are given adequate legal counsel. The most controversial element of the bill will again be gun control, which Democrats say they will attempt to pass separately if necessary. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the Capitol.
President Clinton has nominated Army General John Shalikashvili to be chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. The 57-year-old Polish-born officer is now supreme commander of NATO forces and has been the officer in charge of planning possible airstrikes in Bosnia. His nomination as chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff must be approved by the U.S. Senate. Pope John Paul II is now in Mexico. Although it's the Pope's third trip there, this is the first time that he was received in Mexico as a head of state. NPR's David Wellner reports from Mexico City.
As the Mexican presidential band played the Vatican's hymn, Pope John Paul II was received in the Yucatan capital of Mérida today with a 21-gun salute. The official reception underscored the resumption of diplomatic relations between Mexico and the Vatican last September that had been broken off for more than a century due to anti-clerical sentiment in Mexico. But today, Mexican President Carlos Salinas warmly received the Pope, whose popularity here easily surpasses that of the government. Upon arriving here from Jamaica, John Paul II praised 5 centuries of Catholicism in Mexico, as well as the spirituality of the country's indigenous peoples. He met with 3,000 Indians from throughout the Americas today. The Pope assured the indigenous peoples that the Catholic Church has always defended them, even though others may have destroyed their civilization. I'm David Wellner in Mexico City.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up more than 10.5 points to close at 3,583.35, a record high, on volume of 268 million shares. This is NPR News. U.S. officials have warned that if Serbian factions in Bosnia continue to hold two mountain areas outside of Sarajevo, this could lead to NATO air attacks. The State Department spokesman termed continued occupation of these two mountains a key element of a Serbian stranglehold in the capital. The spokesman also said that this does not mean that Serbian occupation of the mountain areas is the only reason for calling airstrikes, but he called it an important element. A Chinese ship is dead in the water off the coast of Iran as U.S. diplomats search for a friendly port where it may dock. U.S. officials believe the ship is carrying industrial chemicals that can be used to make poison gas. NPR's Dan Charles reports.
The ship, the Yinhe, left China nearly a month ago, bound for Iran. U.S. officials say its cargo includes two chemicals, thiodiglycol and thionyl chloride, that are part of recipes for deadly mustard and nerve gas. The chemicals have peaceful uses as well, but they're supposed to be tightly controlled under a new treaty banning chemical weapons. Chinese officials deny that the chemicals are on board, but U.S. officials say the Chinese have agreed to inspect the ship, and if they do find the chemicals, stop the delivery. The U.S. is now searching for a port where the inspection can happen, but U.S. allies in the region are refusing to let the ship dock, apparently because they are afraid of angering their neighbor, Iran. This is Dan Charles in Washington.
Beginning the 1st of October 1995, the U.S. Marine Corps will not allow people who are married to join the Corps. The military service says it already has everyone in its ranks take classes aimed at discouraging early marriages. According to military officials, the steps are being taken because of a growing number of troubled marriages among young Marines, and this, they say, affects the entire service. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Paquito de Rivera has become an international jazz star. He was born in Cuba in 1948. He loved jazz even as a child when he was studying clarinet and saxophone. But after the revolution, the government was very unenthusiastic about music that came from America. De Rivera defected to America in 1980 in order to play what he wanted with whom he wanted. Now his music reflects his love of jazz, classical, and Latin music. This is a Cuban dance from his recent album La Habana Rio Connection. He's featured on clarinet. Recording a lot of Cuban dances. Did you play a lot of these dances when you were living in Cuba?
Actually, that first dancer that is recorded in my CD, The Havana Rio Connection, was one of the first pieces I ever played in my life. My father used to love that dance, and then that's why I recorded it. Yes, I play that a lot in my country, and I keep playing because I love it.
When you were in Cuba, did the government approve of these dances, or was this something they wanted you to play or wanted you not to play?
I will tell you something. If some of my friends in Cuba listen to me now, they will start laughing because they used to call me Paquito the American, Paquito the Gringo is there, because I used to play only American music, only jazz music. I listened to, you know, I used to say that the best typical band in the world was Count Basie, and the best typical singer was Tony Bennett. You know, the best salsa singer was John Williams or something like that. That means that in there, that was forbidden. No, there was not a law forbidding playing jazz music, but the repression was so strong that you know that was no welcome playing that type of music. So when I arrive in this country, I feel free to play whatever I want. And then I start playing some Latin American music. I also discover Latin America at the banks of the Hudson River.
Right, right. when you were in Cuba, what kind of music did the government most approve of? If they discouraged you from playing jazz, what did they want you to play?
Cuban music or some type of European music or preferably Russian music or whatever. Whatever that is not American. But in the meantime, they are so contradictory that they had a yearly jazz festival there. I know it's very contradictory, but that's the way it works, you know. That was the way Lenin invented this thing.
What was the nightlife like when you were living in Cuba and performing
beautiful.
There?
Beautiful. I remember that there was a guy, he was the minister of something of Russia. That was one of the first visitors from Russia that we have there, after Nikita Khrushchev, I believe. His name was Anastas Mikoyan. Anastas Mikoyan was a guy who visited there, Havana, around 1960 or 1961. I remember that my father was playing the saxophone in a beautiful American hotel by the name of the Hilton Hotel. Nothing to do with Hilton Ruiz at all. The Hilton Hotel. And in that name, in those times, he changed the name to Havana Libre, which means Free Havana Hotel. And then my father was playing there, and he was visiting there, the cabaret. And Anastas Mikoyan showed up with Che Guevara there. And then, you know what they say? The guy say, Anastas Mikoyan say to the conductor there, who was in that time a great piano player called Fernando Mullins. He say, you know what I recommended? Never let go down your beautiful nightlife. 3 years later, there was no more nightlife there. This man was so much in love with the nightlife of Havana. That was something very special. And they destroyed, like everything else.
You're saying Che said never?
No, Che Guevara, that man don't have any sense of humor at all. I am talking about Anastas Mikoyan. He recommend us to keep that beautiful nightlife forever. Because in Russia, you know, I don't know if you have been there. It's terrible, the nightlife there. That doesn't exist.
Saxophonist and clarinetist Paquito de Rivera is my guest. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Cuban-born jazz musician Paquito de Rivera. If musicians were discouraged from performing jazz, how did you get to hear so much jazz and fall in love with it?
Thanks to the radio. Mm-hmm. There is a gentleman that we love very much. We have a great appreciation of his work, not only in Cuba, but in all the communist countries in Europe. His name is Willis Canover from The Voice of America. He used to have, and he has still, after, I think it's like almost 40 years, a program called the Jazz Hour of the Voice of United States of America. The Voice of America. And we used to listen to that program every day at 3 o'clock. That was the way we stay informed of what happened in the jazz world. In the country that jazz was permitted to play.
Your father was a classical musician, and he performed, I believe, in a symphony in Cuba. Was classical music considered the music of imperialists also?
No, not really. They have a they used to have a very fine symphony orchestra. Many musicians, many students, they have some type of scholarship to study in the Soviet Union. No, that was not part of their target.
But your father left Cuba with your mother in the 1960s. Why did they leave?
For the same reason 2 million Cubans left for living in Miami. The oppression was too much, and was not any way to be yourself. You have to be all the time waiting for them, expecting their orders. You know, if you offer an opinion there, they wait until Castro talks and Castro's speeches to say what they think. So my mother was always a very, very liberal person. We came from a poor family, you know, lower middle class. But my mother was always a free person. And then she said, well, there's no way I can live with this man giving orders all over the place. So they left in 1968.
Why didn't you leave with them?
Because I wasn't permitted. I was in what they call military age. How do you like that? They call it They call it the military age is from 16 to 27. Then after 27 is when you have the right to present your document, your papers, and you claim your desire to leave the country. And that can last 5 years or 20. Like my friend, the bassoon player Alberto Romeo, he had to wait for 20 years for them to let him go out of the country.
I want to play something else from your recent album, forgive my pronunciation, La Habana Rio Connection. And this is Noche Cubana. Would you say something about it before we hear it?
Oh, that's another jewel of José Portillo de la Luz, Noche Cubana and Cuban Night. The arrangement is by another giant of the orchestration in my country. His name is Germán P. Ferrer. Noche Cubana, de César Portillo de la Luz.
I guess Paquito de Rivera. When you were growing up in Cuba, you were a prodigy playing both clarinet and saxophone. Your father was a classical musician. Did he teach you?
Yes, my father was my first inspiration to be a musician. He used to be a classical saxophone player who loved jazz music too. From him, I learned this phrase of Duke Ellington that there is only two kinds of music, good and bad. And I learned so much from my father because when he didn't have enough knowledge, you know, in some certain type of matter, then he has so many good friends, which were great musicians, people like Felix Guerrero, Ernesto Lecuona, all those giants of Cuban music. And then I was able to use all those people as my teachers too. So my childhood was a happy one, surrounded by all I wanted to know about that was music, good music.
It was in 1980 that you defected to the United States. It was the end of a concert tour. You were in Spain. And
no, was the beginning of a concert tour?
Oh, I'm sorry. It was the beginning of a concert tour.
Yeah.
Okay, so you were in Madrid, I believe, and you sought asylum at the U.S. Embassy there.
Mm-hmm.
What did you do? Did you just show up there? Did they know you were coming?
No, that was a funny comedy drama because I escaped running. There was an electric stair that was, you know, coming up, and I got down to that stair, and I have 3-day visa, and I run in the taxi. Well, that was like something like a James Bond movie thing.
So were there people following you when you were running?
No, that's what I thought. That's what I thought, because the paranoia, when you live in those countries, the paranoia put you in your mind that everybody's watching you. They can't watch 10 million people. But, you know, it's your paranoia, you think that everybody's behind you. There was nobody behind me because nobody knew what we were going to do.
How do you think your playing has changed since you moved to New York?
Oh, so much. You know why? Because here you have the opportunity to meet people from all over the world. So for me, it's a pleasure to meet people from the Arab countries and from Puerto Rico and from Europe and from Africa and all that. So you learn so much from those people. And I was lucky enough that to be the musical director of the Dizzy Gillespie United Nations Orchestra. In that orchestra, we had people from all over the place. The Argentinians, the Brazilians, the Afro-Americans, the Jews, everybody, man. So that gives you the opportunity, if you are smart enough, to take advantage of that situation and learn for all of them, so that enrich your playing a lot.
I want to close our interview with something from your forthcoming album, which will come out, we think, in mid-September. Uh-huh. This is the piece that opens the new album. It's a circusy kind of march. Would you say something about it?
Yeah, that was written by a very dear friend of mine who he left Cuba many years ago. We used to play together in a theater called Teatro Musical de La Habana, the musical theater of Havana. And then in those days, I was 15 years old, and in those days, I received a telegram from the military service that I had to go there, to the service. And I was very sad, and that was terrible for me. And then this man has such a sense of humor, and then he composed this for me called Descarga, which is like a Cuban jam session for marching band and jazz combo.
Oh, I get it. Right.
Oh, man, that's funny, huh?
Because you were a jazz musician going into the military. Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, that's great. It's really a fun piece, I have to say.
Yeah. I learned from there is the two musicians that I admire the most is Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart and Lizzy Gillespie. And both of them have so much seriousness and deepness in their art. And they have, in the other hand, they have so much sense of humor, both of them, that I think I am sure that sense of humor and deepness in your playing have nothing against each other. You know what I'm talking about?
Right, there's no contradiction to
do both. It's no contradiction. So the sense of humor in my music is present, that the same way it was present in the music of Mozart and Dizzy. I am not trying to compare myself with those people.
No, I understand. A pleasure to talk with you. Paquita de Rivera, thank you very much for being with us.
Hope to see you soon. In Havana, maybe.
Paquita de Rivera's new record, 40 Years of Cuban Jam Sessions, will be released in September on Rounder Records. This is Fresh Air. President Clinton unveiled his crime bill today. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, what will you have on All Things Considered?
Hi, Terry. We'll report on that bill. It calls for $3.4 billion to be spent. It includes the provisions of the Brady Gun Control Bill and provides for more than 50,000 additional police officers on the street in America. I'll talk with a young man in New Zealand who fell more than 3,000 feet into a duck pond. It was a skydiving accident. He was lucky. He was uninjured. And we'll also talk with his father, who watched him fall. His father had helped train him and thought surely that the fall would be fatal. Pope John Paul II visits Mexico. David Wellner has that story. And I'll talk with Steve Zalian, the director of the new film Searching for Bobby Fischer.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. James Lee Burke has a new mystery novel featuring the Cajun detective Dave Robichaux. It's the sixth in the series. The novels are mainly set in Louisiana, an area Burke knows from growing up on the Texas-Louisiana Gulf Coast. Critic John Leonard has a review of In the Electric Mist with Confederate Dead.
I thought James Lee Burke had finally put it all together in his last Dave Robichaux mystery novel, A Stained White Radiance. As if down in New Iberia, Louisiana, Faulkner had teamed up with Ross MacDonald and Freud with Rambo. But In the Electric Mist with Confederate Dead is even better, dreaming its way through violence to honor. Robichaux is back in the bayou, a part-time deputy sheriff and part-time fisherman, a collector and protector of the orphans of the world, somehow making it to a 12-step meeting every time he's tempted to drink again, when bottles in a barroom mirror get mystical on him. Dark green and slender, stoppered with wet corks, he says, and obsidian black with arterial red wax seals, and frosted white like ice sawed out of a lake, and whiskey brown, singing with heat and light. And the music is Juke Joint Zydeco, with Sam Hogman Patton on harmonica and bottleneck blues guitar. And the weather is biblical, with black sunsets and rabbits in the tops of trees, and a houseboat floating by, upside down, tangles of fishing net strung out of its window like flotsam from the socket of an eye. To this mix, add a town so corrupt it will sell itself to anybody, redfish to restaurants and alligators to the Japanese and oyster beds and wetlands to the oil companies. A lynching that occurred 45 years ago and is still being covered up. A Civil War movie being filmed nearby with mob money from New Orleans. A serial rapist and murderer who preys on young prostitutes. Old nightmares of Vietnam and something brand new to a sober Robichaux. A vision, in the mist, of General John Bell Hood and his gray-coat Confederate cavalry, sitting around a campfire with their cheroots and their canteens and their wounded, thinking out loud about chivalry and collective guilt. Robichaux talks to Hood. Hood says, "Oh, we were always honorable, Robert Lee, Jackson, Albert Sidney Johnston, A.P. Hill, but we served venal men and a vile enterprise." Robichaux says to Hood, "People don't get to choose their time in history, General." Hood will leave behind a crutch for Robichaux to stand on, and Matthew Brady will take a photograph. The whole novel goes up like Hood's Confederate balloon fashioned from the silk dresses and petticoats of the ladies of Louisiana. We look down, like birds or gods, from the pickle merchant's wicker basket at a series of surprises. At the first FBI agent Robichaux has ever brought himself to like. At a thug with principles. At a Hollywood director who may also have principles. At a drunk who loses the love of his life but actually saves his soul. And at a woman wearing a Raging Cajun's T-shirt with Robichaux's name on it, who takes a bullet meant for him, a bullet that cut a hole like a rose petal in the back of her shirt and left an exit wound in her throat that made me think of wolves with red mouths running through the trees. We see in the electric mist snakes' tongues and cotton candy and black flags and tobacco fields and slave plantations and wild hogs grazing on the bodies of the dead. It turns out that Robichaux will get to choose his time in history. It also turns out that from that history, James Lee Burke has made some splendid literature.
John Leonard is media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed In the Electric Mist with Confederate Dead. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Joan Tuohy, and Naomi Person, with Dorothy Farabee and Nancy Greenlease. Research assistance from Louisa Shafia. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional grants are provided by the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Dr. Dean Ornish has developed a program for reversing heart disease through a non-fat diet and stress reduction. It recently became the first lifestyle therapy for heart disease to qualify for reimbursement from a major insurance company. On the next Fresh Air, we'll talk with Dr. Ornish. He also recommends his diet if you want to eat more yet lose weight. Join us for the next Fresh Air.